Today, this is the only place in all the world to be.
Gee, but it's good to Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we speak with Clea Blackhurst. We also review Anne on Broadway, The Drawer Boy, Jackie at the Women's Project, Rent at Wagner College, and The Lying Lesson in Hit the Wall. Please stay tuned for more.
But it's good to be here. I really feel in reform. There's nothing like this, not anywhere. There's a magic that fills the air. I'm so ecstatic. I could yell. I could dance about. To be emphatic, I could shout, 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 shout it.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, March 11th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being The Broadway MVPs, 1960 to 2010, The Most Valuable Players of the Past 50 Seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
I want to let people know that Peter is playing wounded. You know,
he's show must go on.
Show must go on, but he's a little hoarse, so he might have to.
He's a little hoarse.
Sorry,
that's what my father always used to say. When are you going to lose some weight? You're a horse, anyway.
Well, we appreciate you coming while you're under duress. I can hear it in your voice already.
Uh-huh.
Also with us is Michael Portantier, who is top of his game as usual. Theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer, and his work can be seen at followsphoto.com and many other places around the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So this evening we have a special guest. Clea Blackhurst is joining us. Clea is an actress, a singer, a comedian, and she is best known for her tribute to Ethel Merman in the show Everything the Traffic Will Allow. Clea is performing in Happy Hunting over at the York coming up very, very soon. Clea, when is that?
Well, it actually is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. This week, the 15th, 16th, and 17th of March.
But you just started rehearsing.
Well, I don't know how many of you have been to a York musicals and must be, but it is a slapdash, wonderfully structured, spontaneous event. I mean, it's just, it's so fast and furious. And part of that deal is, you hold the scripts all the way through, and actually, you're not allowed to put the scripts down. That's like part of what that contract is with Equity, which is a way that Equity protects actors so that people cannot be asked to do things that cannot be accomplished with a script in your hand. So so we have that little protection, but obviously it's more fun to get away from the script and just have it in your hand. But it's great. It's an unbelievable. I've only done one of them back during the Roger Centenary in 2002, I did By Jupiter for the York. And so I have lived through this once, and I'm sure a week from now I will have lived to tell the tale, and it'll be a fun one. So I hope.
So
of course. Did they think of you for this? Did they call you up and say it's going to be you?
Yes. And I'm very happy about that. You know, at first, Jim Morgan from the York called me and said, I'm thinking I really want to do Happy Hunting for you with the series. And I thought, oh no, you know, because I mean, here's the thing. I never wanted to be necessarily it's somebody who was thought of in this sort of Merman box who couldn't get out of it, you know?
Yep.
And as the years have gone by, I've sort of naturally come out of it on my own. In fact, 2002 was a very interesting year. I had just kind of come onto the scene in New York City. And I was everywhere in 2002 doing Oklahoma for the proms at the Royal Albert Hall and all kinds of projects, these concerts. And I was struck that year because I said, you know what? Ethel Merman never, and I mean never, sang a Richard Rodgers song.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, there was something about me that sort of stuck and I got to stay around. But as the years have gone by, I'm sort of honored you know, it's like, well, I don't know if I want to do happy hunting, but I sure don't want anybody else to do it. Yeah. So I decided, and I'm surprisingly in love with the piece. I'm actually really amazed at how Mammon just clearly was having such a difficult time with the whole experience that as time went on, historically, she just really minimized this show so that all of us would kind of not think very highly of it and that it would sort of disappear. And she did a pretty good job of that. You know, I was surprised when I got in there. It's like, it's a pretty darn good Lindsay and Krauss book.
I totally agree.
Yeah, okay, good. I mean, it's like we really, you know, I've sort of taken a tone in my shows and stuff, sort of, you know, just a knowing sort of put down, not really saying anything explicit, but not giving it any respect. And I really take it all back now.
Yeah, it's a very professional book, and it makes perfect sense. It certainly has the time-honored theory about the American who goes to Europe.
Yep.
And here she is. She wants to go to Grace Kelly's wedding. She's not invited.
Right.
But it has more to do with the fact that she wants it for her daughter.
Right.
That's what she's doing. And the daughter sees that she lies, but the daughter loves her because she knows how much her mother loves her, too.
Exactly.
That's terrific.
Exactly. No, it's got a good little story, and it's got a very solid book of, I mean, those guys knew how to write for Ethel Merman, but they knew how to write for other people. You know, they kind of, they know how to set up a joke and deliver it very cleanly, boom, 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 and you're laughing and on to the next one. You know, it's great.
Well, they really did know how to write for her. They really come down to brass tacks. I mean, she says what's on her mind, and she knows what she wants to say, and she doesn't apologize for anything she says. She does it her way, and it comes out wonderfully.
Well, I think those guys, Lindsay and Krauss, you know, were on record as saying they were kind of delighted when they found out Merman, you know, they just found her very funny, and she didn't even understand why they thought she was funny, which was kind of the magic of Merman in a way. so that they come on the scene with Anything Goes. That's their very first collaboration, and it's, of course, a Merman hit from the 30s, and they just stick with her throughout, and they get more and more polished at, like, knowing her as a person, as a friend, and finding her funny.
Well, so, I agree entirely.
Both Peter and I have our believe it or not, have our happy hunting experiences. As I've said several times on the podcast, I actually saw a high school production.
Really?
In like 1979, because we had on Staten Island, there was this this Catholic school with this incredibly progressive nun.
What?
You know, who, I mean, progressive or maybe regressive in a she would do these incredibly obscure shows, and because she didn't want to do the 354th production of Oklahoma. You know?
I love it. I love
and
that.
So she did Happy Hunting, but something Peter told me that I did not know. I mean, I did know that some of the songs were, as the run progressed, I believe, some of the songs were replaced. Some of the Doobie and Carr songs were replaced by songs written by Roger Edens.
Yes.
But I did not know, and of course it makes perfect sense, that included Gee, But It's Good to Be Here.
Yeah. Is that for sure, Peter?
Well, I'll tell you this. In 1977, when I saw a revival on 47th Street, Matt Doobie worked with the company, and he had them replace Gee, But It's Good to Be Here with the original song that was in that place, which was called The International Set Yet.
Wow.
In other words, like as an expression, The International Set Yet, you know?
Yeah,
In the end, she came to the conclusion, I will beat The International Set Yet.
Wow.
You know, in the future. So it was in there, and it was a pretty nice song. But obviously, if he was working with the company and said, I want this back in.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty definitive. I'll buy that.
So it makes perfect sense, because if she, as Peter said, if she had such a bad experience with Doobie and Carr,
right,
why would she continue to sing, you know?
Right.
And really, that song, you know, it's a great song, but it doesn't sound anything like Doobie and Carr, and it sounds totally like Roger Edens.
Right, right. So, you know, what's kind of interesting about being sort of a Merman, expert, what am I? You know, I mean, I've kind of followed all these stories, and, you know, I got a chance and made a pretty educated I had an educated opinion on this very issue of the songs being interpolated. Gee, But It's Good to Be Here, you know, doesn't sort of hang with the same. I guess the difference is the play opened on Broadway with Gee, But It's Good to Be Here in place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the other two songs, the show opened with the Doobie Carr songs, and they were recorded on the cast album, and that's what people hear when they hear the cast album. But Merman got very tired of, he just decided not to sing them anymore, and then commissioned Roger Edens to write two more. So there are actually, in that sense, there are four songs there that you know, we sort of went through with the director of this and the musical director and the York and said, well, which do we do? And I was sort of surprised to find myself definitely landing on the side of the Doobie Carr songs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Without question. Huh?
Tell me why.
Well, because I think it was very clear to me as somebody who loves Merman. I mean, I love Merman, but I get her. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not blinded to her faults or anything sort of like human about her. And I think it is so clear laying these songs out. One of them, it's a little bit of a toss-up. Just a moment ago, I think is beautiful, and it's the Roger Edens song. And in fact, I perform that in my own show. When I stop and talk about Happy Hunting, I kind of tell that story of the songs being replaced and Roger Edens writing this beautiful song. That one's a little bit of a toss-up. But later in the show is a song called The Game of Love. And it's a very beautiful, very concise, small in structure song, and it's just beautiful. Her reflecting, like, I've loved this guy, but I might have lost him. I'm not sure. It's a game. It's a roulette wheel, whatever. Mm-hmm. The imagery is. And the song that she had Roger Edens put in is a real, it's almost like a fear factor song. Like, I'm afraid to be vulnerable there. Give me something like, I'm old enough to know better, but I'm young enough to not care. Yuckity, yuckity, yuck. And it completely is opposite of what the moment clearly was in the structure. And she just interpolated something there that made her very comfortable, I think. Like, I don't want to slow down again. I want to just dazzle them with my quick wit and my little belt, you know. So I really thought, and also if you're talking about the York and musicals and Muffy and letting these shows be heard that have never been heard, in that particular argument, I fell down on the side of the composers, of the creators, and not on the side of the star who clearly had a lot of power, which surprised me.
We should mention, in case people don't know, that I just love this, I'm not sure which one it was, Doobie or Carr, but
yeah,
one of them is the person who is parodied in Bells Are Ringing.
That's right.
As the dentist.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Broadway
It's Carr, and he was the composer. And apparently, now we have met this darling Aaron, who is the grandnephew of Harold Carr. And he tells us that he was a very happy dentist. He loved being a dentist. In other words, he was not filling time while he was filling teeth. He really liked it. And Doobie was the one who was like, come on, man. And they were well known for writing mambos and rumbas and sambas and stuff. And he kind of kept them going as a team. And, you know, and Carr was like, okay. He kind of went along with it. He didn't have his whole life wrapped up in it because he was very happy writing jokes and writing songs. But I love that it's a very culturally, if you think about 1956, Bells Are Ringing, this, that it's like he must have been pretty well known in those circles to be sort of like given this, you know, he kind of lives on in the lore a little bit among the in-the-know set.
Right.
Well, I hate to burst bubbles here.
Yeah.
But I will tell you this. One time I said to Betty Comden, did you have Harold Carr in mind when you wrote Bells Are Ringing? And
yeah.
She said, no.
Oh, uh-huh. I don't want to hear that.
She said, what it was, my dentist that I went to loved to play music, not songs he wrote,
uh-huh,
play music on the air hose. He thought it was perfect. I'd come in, he'd be playing one of my songs. You know.
I love it.
So that's her story. Now,
that's brilliant.
We all know that people forget. And
mm-hmm.
But in her defense, too, don't forget that Happy Hunting opened after bells are ringing. So
right.
It does lend credence to that story.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're right. It's interesting to go back into all of these, right? And like, what? But I would see there again, I would buy Betty Compton's account of it. But I'm perfectly happy to live with this other myth as well.
Oh, yeah.
So can we develop some new myths here?
Yes.
Tell us about, you know, the Nutty Professor and what your experience was like in Nashville. And tell us about the show itself.
Well, the Nutty Professor is something I've been involved with for about 5 or 6 years. And it's a new musical, which has ended up being somewhat noteworthy, or people know about it because it was Marvin Hamlisch's final score. And he passed away while we were in, very unexpectedly. I mean, that was like not in the cards at all. Very unexpectedly, while we were actually performing in Nashville. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of squeaking in on a little bit of his legacy because, I've never, believe it or not, you'll believe it because it's true, I have never been in a Broadway show. In spite of the fact that I have carved out a completely Broadway-related career, and a lot of, you know, I get to be on benefits as Broadway celebrates this and Broadway celebrates that, but I've just kind of like made my own little place coming out of the sort of a musical theater historian who performs rather than writes books. I've kind of made this little niche for myself, but The Nutty Professor is a real kind of old-fashioned, I would call it a musical comedy, you know, when we used to call them musical comedies.
Yeah.
It has a book by Rupert Holmes, and the music is Marvin Hamlisch, and it is directed by Jerry Lewis. And when I say Jerry Lewis, yes, I mean that Jerry Lewis. And I came to this project because somebody gave Jerry my first CD, which is recorded live, so I tell stories and I sing. And he says he listened to it 4 times in his car and became consumed with this idea that I was a 21st century Kathleen Freeman, who is the actress who played Miss Lemon in the original 1963 film of The Nutty Professor, which was written, directed, and starring Jerry Lewis. So it's really his baby. So I got a call from Jerry Lewis Films. Is there a time I could come to Las Vegas and meet Mr. Lewis? I was just like, Jerry Lewis, Jerry Lewis, like, who is this? What do you, you know, who wants to know? So I flew out there, and within the first couple minutes, he offered me this part. And at that time, there was me and Jerry Lewis and Michael Andrew, who is the young actor behind the whole idea. That was all that was involved with The Nutty Professor. And as the years unfolded and they got Marvin on board and then Rupert on board, so Jerry has just stayed very loyal to me, and I ended up getting to, you know, I've still stuck with my part all the way till Nashville. So I don't know exactly what we're waiting on, but I'm among all those actors who have been in shows where you know when it works and you know when it doesn't quite work.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing works. The blackout before the curtain calls is like magical. Like, oh my gosh, you guys, this actually works. So I have very high hopes that whatever they're working out in their fundraising or theater or whatever that alchemy is that brings it all together, I do believe it will happen. And people are going to love finding out what Marvin was up to. Especially, he wrote an overture for it and he was very proud of it. And I loved it because I entered right at the beginning, so I got to stand kind of behind this curtain listening to it every night, and it's just great, great stuff. So it was thrilling.
Yeah, Marvin used to, at benefits, play his overture for Chorus Line.
Yes.
That was never used.
Yes.
He really envisioned one, and so I know overtures were very important to him. Was he around a lot during rehearsals?
He was around. I got to do 2 full workshops of it, and then this production. The rehearsal period for the production that happened in Nashville, he wasn't around all that much because I think he was kind of struggling with not being around too many germs kind of thing. Like, he was fine, but he was kind of like watching and not being too exposed, you know. But so we didn't. He ended up only being in Nashville for a little while, and then he was actually coming back to us when he passed away in Los Angeles. So it was unfortunately we didn't get as much of him as we would have liked at that point, but he was dealing with Rupert all day, every day on the phone and the computers and everything. And Rupert Holmes, who I think is one of the most lovely men in show business and talented, really was a great cohesive, you know, he really like spoke for Marvin and let us like feel very loved by Marvin. And I've heard from Marvin's wife and his friends that he was so pleased with the reviews that were coming out that he was in the hospital and he was having people read them. You know, he like, read it again, like read this, listen to this, you're going to love it. So I think he had a great affection for the piece and saw it as a very, you know, what's surprising about it is it's actually a very, it's got a lot of heart. And I sort of see it in my own mind, I see it as a show that could be The Wicked or The Cinderella, not for little girls and their birthday parties and their mothers bringing them back, but actually for 9, 10, 11-year-old boys.
Uh-huh.
It opens literally with a bang, with a giant explosion of the laboratory exploding. And it's, you know, it's the nerdy guy who wants to change himself to get the girl, but it's like learning to love yourself and not putting up with bullies and things that they didn't really set out to make it anything preachy or anything like that. It's just this very beautiful laying out of like, learn to be yourself. And I love it. I really have my fingers crossed, and it's the kind of show I would like to see on Broadway. And it's a role I would love to bring, you know, I'd love to like have my part and get to, this would be my perfect Broadway show for me.
Mm-hmm.
Something that feels old fashioned in structure, but it's actually brand new. It's perfect.
Of course, Rupert Holmes is no stranger to writing songs. So as a result, if you need a few extra,
yeah,
I imagine he could step in and do some.
Well, he has said in an interview that I saw since Marvin passed away, that there are actually several songs that are, you know, part of this project that if they wanted to do something with it, yeah, obviously Rupert could take Marvin's work and expand it, or he could, I mean, yes, he is a go-to guy for that kind of thing. But really, Marvin's work, I think, in everybody's mind was pretty much done. It's not like there were great, you know, holes left on, you know, that weren't filled. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
All right. Well, we're going to see you in the very near future this weekend at Happy Hunting at the York.
I can't wait.
The Mufti series.
And
and hopefully we'll see the Nutty Professor soon afterwards.
Thank you. I hope you're right.
Well, everybody can catch up with Clea at CleaBlackhurst.com or on Facebook at Facebook.com/CleaBlackhurst and see all the other things that she has going on. You can get her albums at Shikaboom and Ghostlike Records and listen to some tracks on her website and everything that you would need to get all Clea Blackhurst. She'll get some t-shirts to sell on there as well.
I know, I got to do that. Okay. I'll look into that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And you know, it's wonderful to hear your voice.
Thank you. It's such an honor. I love all of you. So it's great to be here tonight.
All right. Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay.
All
you
right.
Too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we have the opening of Anne on Broadway. So Peter has seen it. Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Anne is about Anne Richards, who was the governor of Texas for a while, and Holland Taylor decided not only to portray her, but to write a play about her, and it's in two acts, and in the first act, she starts out by being at a graduation and giving a graduation speech, and while she was doing it, I thought, good Lord, is she actually going to give a graduation speech for 2 hours? I mean, this is incredible. I mean, this is a very bad idea if this is what she's going to do, because nobody would sit still for anybody talking for 2 hours at a graduation. It reminds me of in Yankee Doodle Dandy when James Cagney goes into Franklin Delano Roosevelt's office and he tells the whole story of his life. I mean, the president's busy. You know, I mean, he doesn't have time for this. but She's smart enough to take us away from the graduation and go back in time. And we see her just starting out, not thinking of being a politician, getting involved in local causes and working her way up. It's a very traditional story for so many women in politics, that they fell into it. And then once they developed a taste for it, certainly not only found that they could succeed at it, but they enjoyed succeeding at it, and they got a great deal of pleasure and gratification knowing they were doing so much good. And eventually, after she is not governor anymore, she comes to New York to work here for some noble causes as well. So my favorite line, of course, occurred when she talked about how she loved going to Broadway and seeing shows. In fact, she was trying to get tickets to go see Lion King again at one point in the play, and I like that. What's really great, she makes us truly care for this lady. And this lady isn't afraid to laugh at her own jokes because she knows she's funny. She's comfortable in her skin, as well as the white suit that's topped by a mane of snow-white hair that Ann Richards was famous for. I mean, it's funny because at one point she talks about going to a Halloween party dressed as, this is her word, I'm not making this up, dressed as a tampon. And I wonder, in fact, if it's the exact outfit she has on, because she's all white. So, I mean, who knows? You know? So I do wonder if she wore what she happened to have on then. So when she comes to the conclusion, why should your life be just about you? Well, you know, frankly, when you're as extraordinary as Ann Richards is and Holland Taylor is, it's all right when there's so much about you, because she really justifies the 2 hours we spend there. It never drags. It's so interesting. Even little details. For example, when she's a governor in the 90s, she's walking around her office on the telephone, maneuvering a long cord. When she comes to New York in 2001, and by the way, her first day was going to be September 11th. That's the day she was starting. She's walking around the office with no cord, you know, on the phone. So those little details are very nice. I really have to give Holland Taylor credit to the immense degree, because after all, it's one thing to perform a one-person show, but to write it and to hone it, it's been around the country. I know a friend who saw it in San Antonio, that it's really something that she has worked on. She's refined it. Frankly, I hope she gets a Tony Award, because I think she deserves it. And don't forget, this is the lady who's the star of Moose Murders. So no matter how far down you are, you know, you can certainly look up and see other things on the horizon. So we won't be remembering Holland Taylor for Moose Murders. We'll be remembering her for Anne.
Oh, how wonderful.
Wow, that's quite an endorsement.
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but they did an item on it on CBS Sunday Morning last week. And I saw that, and it's aside from everything else, her physical transformation is quite extraordinary, because
yep.
She does not really look that much like her. And Richards had a much fuller figure and face than Holland Taylor, but somehow with the makeup and the hair, it's quite extraordinary.
Well, Michael, you of all people know better than all of us what hair can do, because your experience with Forbidden Broadway. I mean, hair is really one of the most important components of making people look like other people.
It's true.
And Gerard has had such success with so many people over the years, because those wigs really do a lot of the work. And I don't mean to take anything away from the people who do Forbidden Broadway, because I've never seen a bad performance at Forbidden Broadway. Never, ever, ever, ever. Everybody is always extraordinary. But nevertheless, you know, the wigs do help.
Oh, sure. You know, I actually saw Ann Richards on stage in one of the Phyllis Newman benefits for the Phyllis Newman. What is the name of that charity? I'm blanking out.
The Women's.
Yes, that
Women's Theater Project.
It's for breast cancer, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, it's for that. And she and Ann Richards was very close friends with Liz Smith. And they both did a number in which they were in cowboy hats. And I'll never forget it. It was absolutely delightful. And I also will never forget I don't know a whole lot about Ann Richards, but I saw her on TV on, you know, something like Meet the Press or something. It was one of these panel things, and someone had made some remark, and people were analyzing it in, you know, political speak. Well, you know, I think that, you know, if you really examine the basic issues here, that you might understand, blah, blah, blah. And then they got to Ann Richards, and she said, well, that's the biggest load of horse shit I've ever heard in my life. And I kind of loved her from that moment. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this show.
You know, if Clea Blackhurst is otherwise engaged this weekend, it's too bad Ann Richards couldn't play the part in Happy Hunting, because that's this type of character that we have in Happy Hunting, a woman who isn't afraid to say exactly what's on her mind in whatever words come to her mouth at that moment. So, of course, we want Clea to do it, and Ann is gone and can't do it, but there would have been a time when Ann Richards might have been really good in Happy Hunting.
Mm-hmm. Just wanted to clarify, it's the Phyllis Newman Women's Health Initiative, and it's part of the Actors Fund of America.
Yes.
And she does the Nothing Like a Dame galas.
Yes, correct.
They've raised $3.5 million since 1995. So, moving on to the next topic, I hesitate to bring it up because I can't pronounce it. Michael, it's called The Drawer Boy. Drawer Boy. And Michael got a chance to see it. Drawer, D-R-A-W-E-R, boy. And Michael got a chance to see it, so I'm going to stop saying it. Michael, keep going.
It's really hard to say it. I didn't realize it until I tried to say it. And the other thing is, it's interesting because it doesn't mean what you would think it means. What do you think it means?
Somebody who draws.
Oh, see, no, that is what it means. Very good, Peter.
not so good. I've seen the play in Sacramento, and I've seen that.
I was thinking it was a boy like Harry Potter who lived in a drawer.
That's what I thought it meant, yes. Well, anyway, as Peter said, it's by a Canadian playwright named Michael Healy. And apparently it has been done quite a lot in various places, including Steppenwolf, very notably. And it's a really terrific play. It reminded me kind of like Sam Shepard. And of course, I mean that as a compliment. Sam Shepard, but maybe a little lighter than that. A little bit of Martin McDonagh in there too. But I don't mean to say that it's derivative in any way. It's just a really terrific, very interesting play, very funny and also kind of creepy and moving at the same time, about this actor who goes to spend some time on a farm in Ontario with these two men who work the farm because he's doing it for research for his acting company. And I won't say anything more because it's one of those plays you really want to avoid the spoilers. But I would urge everyone to see it. It's a wonderful production directed by Alexander Dinolaris, who's also a terrific playwright. I know him more as a playwright, actually, but he's directing this show. And it's down at the Abingdon Theater on 36th Street and that complex on 36th Street. And it's really quite extraordinary, and I urge everyone to see it.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes, and the graphic on it. And once you see the graphic, it becomes evident that it's about a boy who draws. So, and it's a quite beautiful graphic there. That's the Abingdon Theater Arts Complex, 312 West 36th, and it's the Oberon Theater Ensemble that is, producing this work.
Yes.
So next up, we're going to talk about Jackie at the Women's Theater Project that Peter got a chance to see. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Yes, Jackie is a one-woman show about Jackie Kennedy, and we meet her after she has died. I can't say, given the look of the set, that the playwright believes Jackie went to heaven, because she looks like she's in a sewer. Now, I don't know if this is an indictment of the way Jackie Kennedy lived, but one of the things about the show is the fact that she has a lot of baggage. And I mean that literally, in the sense, not with suitcases, but she carries around with her three enormous inflatable dolls. There's nothing sexual going on here. One of the dolls has a JFK on it, another one says RFK, and another one says Ari. So it deals with her husband, her brother-in-law, and her second husband. So they, of course, predeceased her. So as a result, it talks about their impact on her and her life. And when you listen to this play, which is a foreign play, by the way, by a playwright now, Elfriede Jelinek, it really does make you have sympathy for Jackie Kennedy you may not know that you have. I'm thinking of my friend Mary Ladinsky, who said to me many years ago, after she had turned 31, she said to me with half-closed eyes, "You know, when I found out that Jackie Kennedy was my age when she went into the White House, I forgave her everything." And it's a very interesting point. I mean, really think about it. First lady at 31, and then to have your husband's head right in your lap after he's killed, and she's always been terribly criticized for jumping out of the car, trying to get out through the back. And a lot of people have said, oh, she was very cowardly. You know, she was afraid she was next, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'd like to see how we all would do if we were in a car in a convertible and the person next to us got shot. I don't know if it would be anybody's finest hour. And the point is that Jackie Kennedy may well have gone crazy. This playwright really suggests that she may very well have. And if she had gone crazy, she was entitled to it. So that was, it's a very, very, very creepy evening in many ways. But one of the things that makes it extraordinary, I mean extraordinary, is the fact the actress who is playing her is just out of this world. Tina Benko is her name. And because this is one of those stop and start stream of consciousness plays, it must have been hell on earth to memorize it, because she just goes from subject to subject. I mean, you know, and flits around and comes back. I mean, it's almost like talking to Carol Channing. You know, I mean, it's all over the place. You never know what she's going to say next. So a terrific performance by this lady. The best one-woman show I've seen this year. And you know how much I loved Anne. So as a result, you have to be so impressed with what this lady is doing. And it is definitely worth going to the Women's Project at the Manhattan Theater Club's second space on 55th Street, right next to City Center, where we go see Encores. So a terrific tour de force performance. I won't say that it's a great play. By no means will I say that. But you have to come away with such admiration for this lady for doing this show.
And maybe we should just clarify that this is not the same show called Jackie that was on Broadway with Margaret Colin some years ago and was a huge, well, I mean, actually, I kind of liked it, but it was not a success.
I did too, but this one is far more perverse.
Okay.
I mean, even down, I mean, think of it. I mean, the set looks like a sewer, and she's dragging around these dolls, inflatable dolls. I mean, right away, this is not what we associate with Jackie Kennedy. I mean, she is wearing a glorious dress designed by Susan Hilferty, one of our best costume designers. But aside from that, she's in a tough place, both physically and mentally. So it's quite a thing.
So in the sewer, wearing a wonderful dress, it sort of reminds me of Rent, doesn't it? Michael got a chance to see a production of Rent at Wagner College over in Staten Island that Michael wanted to mention to us. So tell us about it, Michael.
I really wanted to mention it because it's a terrific production. It's unfortunately over now. I saw it in the second of its two weekends, directed by Michelle Paulk.
Oh.
Who is on the faculty there now. But I think she has not directed too much there because she's also, you know, a busy woman and still performing. Boy, it was so, you know, I'm going to say it was better directed than the original. I always had some problems with the original. I thought this was much more clear in terms of storytelling and blocking. I did. And so absolute, you know, kudos to her and also to the choreographer, Ashley Delaine Berger. It was quite something to see Grant with actors who are really about, you know, just about exactly the ages that they should be. And it's not the first production I've seen like that, but it's maybe only the second or third, and it's always quite quite extraordinary. The talent was just amazing. Let me mention everyone, because I think you'll be hearing for some of them again. Roger was Robbie Haltewanger. I think he should do something about that, because he's really great, but I don't know about that name. Mark Cohen was Alex Boniello. Tom Collins was Dave Resultan. And that was interesting, because I believe he appeared to be Filipino. You know, that role, anytime I've seen it, has always been played by an African American. So that, but there's nothing in it that says anything about what race he's supposed to be. So that was wonderful. Benny was Justin Stevens. Joanne was Jenny Kelly. Mimi was this wonderful, amazing woman named Olivia Puckett. Angel was Anthony Colasuono, who just the audience just adored him. And Maureen was Melanie Brooke, who was quite hilarious. Her performance piece, you know, Over the Moon, Moo with Me. The audience was in stitches. It was just great, and everything about it was fantastic. And I'm so glad I saw it.
Well, this is very interesting. You say, Michael, about the book being clearer as a result of the direction. Your feelings about the original have to be supported by the playbill, because after Rent was running a while, they actually put a synopsis in the playbill of what the story was. So obviously people were confused by it. There was a schematic where they had everybody's head, they had arrows, that type of thing, you know, this one's involved with that one and all those kinds of stuff. And, you know, to be fair, had Jonathan lived, he might very well have made it more clear himself. But nevertheless, I don't think Michael Greif did any favors by not making it clearer. People come down very hard on the Rent movie, and I understand why they do, but the story is clearer in the Rent movie, the story itself, than it is on stage.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the fact that, you know, it's much harder to tell a story in a through-sung musical. And it's not through-sung completely, but a lot of it is sung dialogue. And there's a lot of kind of important information that that comes at you really quickly in the first part of the show, the exposition, where you're kind of being introduced to the characters, and it's all, most of it is sung. And I think that's part of the problem, and which is less of a problem in the movie, because a lot of that sung dialogue was turned into speech. But then also, as you say, on top of that, I do think that some of the blocking and some of the direction of Michael Greif was not that clear. So those two things combined created something of a problem. But it was less so here, and also partly maybe because I just know it so much better now. But I do think that Michelle's blocking was clearer and less more focused and less frenetic. So I can't say enough about how wonderful it
was. And lest we come down too hard on Michael Greif, let us also remember he's the only person in the history of mankind to have directed two Pulitzer Prize-winning musicals, because, of course, he did Next to Normal as well.
Oh, how interesting.
You know, credit where it's due, whether we like him or not. You know, I mean, he obviously has something to have guided two shows to Pulitzer Prizes.
So I'm thinking about other musicals which I would like to have a graphic that would describe the story. Like, you know, I don't know if you've seen those graphics on the internet where they have, you know, an icon and an arrow and things like that. But I'm thinking Aspects of Love might need one of those.
You know, I'm going to see Aspects of Love in Amsterdam in April in Dutch. And I bet it makes as much sense to me there than it's English. But you can't keep me away with a stick. I'm definitely going.
I don't recall it being especially confusing. I didn't like it at all, but
the way people behave is pretty confusing, I'll tell you. I mean, you know.
Well, love changes everything.
Yeah, but so does shooting a gun at somebody. I mean, it's very hard to believe that such forgiveness would come so quickly when somebody shoots a gun at you. So at the risk of plugging a book I have coming out in May about Tony losers, I do talk a lot about aspects of love and why I think it didn't work. So May 28th, if you're in the mood, take a look at that and see if you if it makes sense to you why I think Aspects of Love is a really difficult show.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. That's great. I didn't realize you're going to write about Aspects. But, and you know, we could go to other Andrew Lloyd Webber shows such as Starlight Express, but we won't get into that right now. So Peter got a chance to see a play called Hit the Wall. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is about the night that Stonewall happened down in the village. And it was funny, on a personal note, I'll do this very quickly. I realized I was in New York that night, and I was only a few blocks away from Stonewall.
Wow.
I was actually coming back from Baltimore, and I saw Little Murders at the now-defunct Circle of the Square Theater. And I had never realized that before, but I came home and checked my book, and yes, indeed. So if I had stayed a little bit longer in the village, I would have been able to witness this firsthand, apparently.
Oh, my God.
That would have really been something. But the fact remains that because I wasn't there, I was very grateful to have a chance to see what happened on June 27th, 1969, as is defined in this play, Hit the Wall. This is definitely the season's most hard-hitting play, and I mean that literally, because a cop isn't above taking out his billy club to a drag queen and a lesbian and really terrorizing them. You do find out what a coward he is at one point and what a terrible person he is, even though he claims he's just doing his job. Yeah, he is just doing his job, and boy, does he love doing his job, being the big shot, and yeah, he's got the power, and he's going to humiliate these people. So there's a very good scene that comes after that that belies the bromide. The two wrongs don't make a right, but I'm telling you, it's very, very potent. I also like the fact that every now and then you hear a line from the boys in the band, because I'd like to think that the gay men in the show had seen Boys in the Band, which had opened a year before, 14 months earlier. And, you know, really, at that time, believe me, a lot of people were quoting lines from Boys in the Band because they were so good. I like, too, that it's at the Barrow Street Theater, because that isn't far from the Stonewall Inn where the revolution took place. And what's even interesting, too, is when you're in the Barrow Street Theater, every now and then you feel underneath you the number one train running underneath you. And, you know, if you're in Stonewall, I think you would have felt the number one train beneath you, too. So I think that's really good. You know, one of the points the play makes is that so many people were so happy about this revolution that they want to take part in it and share in it. So a lot of people have claimed, I was there that night. And it does bring up the point that no, not everybody who claims he was there that night was there that night. That's a little bit too much to believe. But I don't think it's impossible that in the years to come, people will be saying, I was there to see Hit the Wall, because it really, really brings home exactly what had to be accomplished in this revolution, and not a moment too soon did it happen. So it's and beautifully, beautifully acted. I'm telling you, the person who plays the drag queen and the one who plays the lesbian are both excellent. The cop's good too. I mean, one of those performances that when he comes out for his curtain call, you know, people hiss, you know, that type of thing. So it really is an extraordinarily potent evening. And once again, the Barrow Street Theater has been reconfigured. It's basically now in an arena setting, and the play takes place in the round, in essence. And the direction really compensates for that very, very nicely, especially when dealing with the neighbors in the neighborhood who aren't thrilled that this neighborhood is suddenly getting a little more vibrant than it used to be, and the people are being a little more explicit about who they love and how they love. Mm. So all these issues come up very, very nicely in Hit the Wall, and I hope it runs for a good long time.
Well, it is going to be running through July 7th, so you have some time to see it, and perhaps it'll have some sort of other life after that.
I hope it extends. You
know, yes. Yeah.
Young writer, Ike Holter, H-O-L-T-E-R, that's his name, I think has a really good grasp of what scene to put in exactly what place it should be in. He does that very, very succinctly and smartly. So good for him.
You know, they have really had some extraordinary plays at the Barrow Street. You know, especially when you think that it wasn't really, you know, a theater until not too long ago. We used to rehearse there every week when I was in the New York City Gay Men's Chorus. And it wasn't a theater then, as far as I know. I mean, I think they had like functions and things.
Sure.
But then it became this, you know, and it's in Greenwich House. And it's you know, but as Peter says, it's reconfigured every time you see something there. It's likely to have a different configuration. Sometimes it's just regular proscenium, but you know, as often as not, it's a thrust or arena or whatever. And it's really, I mean, our town played there forever, but they Biglia was there and Tribes, yes, and just really a lot of Bug was there.
Sure.
You know, it's become quite almost a destination.
Destination. I would use that word. Yes, yeah. I would. And it's really quite nice that it's happened.
Yes.
All right. So moving on, Michael got a chance to see Megan Hilty at the Pops. So Michael, tell us, how was Megan?
Oh, she was great. It was interesting because this concert was to have originally start set McFarlane. But he was going to do an evening of Sammy Kahn, but then he dropped out, presumably because he got the Oscars gig. Although, honestly, I mean, that was over several weeks ago, and these kind of things don't usually take that much rehearsal anyway. And also, you know, presumably a lot of almost anything he would have done would have already been in his repertoire from his concerts, but for whatever reason he dropped out. And so they turned to Megan Hilty to pick up the slack, and then they changed the program. And they also added Ryan Silverman, who's currently in Passion off Broadway, to do probably some of the things that Seth would have done. But Megan also, I think, sang a lot of, the concert opened with Megan singing Luck Be a Lady, which is Frank Lesser, of course. So the bad news is that there was no kind of really kind of coherence to the program at all. It seemed like a very mixed bag of all different composers, from Cy Coleman and Carolyn Lee to Lerner and Lowe, Frank Lesser, Leslie Bricus and Anthony Newley, Kurt Vile. But other than that, you know, if you don't mind that, it was just fantastic to hear the orchestra play these amazing arrangements by, you know, people like Nelson Riddle, and they did the famous Nelson Riddle, Judy Garland arrangement of Come Rain or Come Shine. Megan did that, which has got to be one of the most difficult arrangements that anyone ever crafted for anyone in history. But she did a fantastic job with it. And Ryan did a lot of great stuff too. And then they ended with It's Not Unusual, Doc Jones number, which the audience loved. So it was terrific. I mean, I don't like to miss any of those New York Pops concerts under Stephen Reinecke, because they're so fantastic. And to be in Carnegie Hall and hear, you know, the orchestra is always completely unamplified. The singers are amplified because it's pop music. But it's a great experience. Although I do have to say, and I guess this is a little bit of a can of worms, and maybe Peter, you'd want to address this. I think the new normal seems to be that actors will sign on to do shows, and then increasingly they will just take off when they have other gigs to do, whether it be concerts or whatever. Yeah. And that ranges from, you know, stars to people who are not necessarily that well known. Kelly O'Hara, I think, has been out of Nice Work of You, If You Can Get It, almost as often as
Audra McDonald. Sure, Paul Gambel certainly did the gigs that she had lined up beforehand. Yeah,
absolutely. Jessica Chastain missed several performances for I think to attend award ceremonies because for awards that she won or was nominated for Zero Dark Thirty. Nick Adams, you know, from Priscilla, actually took off a performance of that show in order to accept an audience award for his performance in that show.
Right.
Now, he shouldn't have been put in that position in the first place. They shouldn't have had it on a night of the performance, but they did, and he took off. And now here again, Ryan Silverman. I mean, he's not a household name, but, you know, he was in Phantom, and he's done a few other things, and there might certainly conceivably be someone who was hoping to see him in Passion and never dreaming that he would be out, you know, to do a concert. I mean, you always have a – obviously, it's a crapshoot if someone might be sick. But, you know, but on top of that, if it's increasingly all of these people are going to be allowed to just miss for concerts and special appearances and things, it's just very, very different from the way it used to be. And I'm not sure that I like it.
Well, of course, we don't like it. But the one thing that has to be said, even though the award that that gentleman was getting was not a significant award, I remember in 1968 when Estelle Parsons was doing The Seven Descents of Myrtle, played by Tennessee Williams, terrible title. The Last of the Mobile Hotshots is the movie title, which is a little better. Crazy, crazy property. But anyway, she was nominated for an Oscar for Bonnie and Clyde. And David Merrick who's the producer, of course, took out the big ad saying, tonight Estelle will not be performing because she's going out to Hollywood to pick up her award for Bonnie and Clyde. And ironically enough, she did win. His prediction turned out to come true. But this is a case of when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, because, I mean, he didn't have her in the show that night, but at least you're reminding people that she's a star, that she's getting she's nominated for an Oscar, which doesn't happen to everybody, to say the least. And here she is. You know, she's not going to be here tonight, but the implication, of course, is she'll be here tomorrow night. So come see the new Oscar when it's tomorrow night. You know, it was a good thing. Lord knows the play didn't run, and for some very good reasons, which you will certainly see if you see the movie, which I urge you to see with a bunch of friends some late night after you've downed a few. You will have the time of your life. You won't come away with much respect for the property, but nevertheless, you will have a good time. So, you know, if it's a major award like that, I think they should get a night off. But yes, I was expecting when I heard that Audra McDonald was signed on for Boogie and Bess, well, there goes those dates, you know, that she was going to come to New Jersey, you know, and I was going to write about. And no, she kept the dates. And to a degree, you have to give her credit for not canceling and disappointing people in New Jersey. She was good to her word. She signed a contract. But yeah, I know it's a sticky situation.
Well, but also the major difference there in what you just mentioned is that there have been no full page David Merrick ads telling you that Kelly O'Hara is not going to be a nice
person,
or any of those other people that I mentioned. So you know, if people know, then it's completely different. But if they have a reasonable expectation that somebody is going to be in a show that's just opened not that long ago, and they're doing a gig with the Pittsburgh Symphony. I don't know. I just think it's one of the many things that has changed about the theater don't like.
Right. Yeah.
So I heard that Audra's got a new television show, and perhaps, you know, while she's shooting her television show, she'll tell the producers, you know, I got to go and do a two-night concert, so I won't be here to shoot.
I don't think so.
You think that happens?
Mm-hmm.
No? Okay. Well, Michael also saw Elaine Page over at Town Hall. So tell us about Elaine Page.
Oh, my God. It was life-changing. I mean, the woman is she has the most phenomenal voice that, I mean, one of the greatest in history, I think. And I've not had the pleasure of seeing her in too many things. You know, I mean, I did see her in Sunset Boulevard, and she was terrific in a show that I really kind of loathe, actually. I was lucky enough to also see her in Sweeney Todd at New York City Opera. But, you know, that's that's such a huge place. And, you know, it's nowhere near the same as seeing her here doing really every one of the amazing songs that she either introduced or you know, either introduced completely or if not, she was like the first person to do it on stage. She was she wasn't the first Evita in the sense that she's not on the concept album. That was Julie Covington, but she was the first Evita in the stage production in London before it came on to Broadway with Patti LuPone. And she was the first Grisabella in Cats. And she was the first Florence in Chess. And, you know, aside from everything else that she did Anything Goes in London and she did The King and I in London. You know, this tiny woman, you know, makes me look tall. But she, this force of nature voice that just comes out, and she did a terrific program at Town Hall. I'm sorry to say, I don't think it was that well publicized. I think when I mentioned it earlier, Peter wasn't even aware of it.
No.
I think that was partly because it might have been somewhat short notice. She's touring the country, but I think the New York gig was actually added somewhat late at the Town Hall because I know it wasn't on a calendar that I saw just a couple of months ago. You know, it wasn't packed, but it certainly wasn't empty, and it was a very, very enthusiastic crowd. Almost all of the cast of Follies were there to cheer her on because she was a very memorable Carlotta Campion in the most recent revival of Follies. And she did all of her hits with four musicians, and her patter was delightful. And I just, I'm thrilled that I saw it because we didn't get to see her do any of those iconic roles on Broadway. So it was like almost like getting it all in one night, and it was extraordinary.
Yeah, I have to say that I liked Glenn Close very much in Sunset Boulevard, but I thought Betty Buckley was better, and I thought that Elaine Page was the best of them all.
Wow.
Yes, the problem is, no question, what Addison DeWitt says to Eve Harrington, you're too short for that gesture. And she was too short for the show, really. But in terms of the performance itself, she was amazing beyond belief. I also did a sit-down with her once at Barnes & Noble when we were lucky enough to have a Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Center. And she was really terrific, very down-to-earth, and just ready to chat and reminisce and have a good time going back to shows that weren't even successful. She was actually in the very first production of The War of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd, when it was done in England. Notice I'm not saying London, because it never got to London. That's really one of the strangest stories, that a show that closed out of town in England later showed up on Broadway. Usually when they close out of town in England, that's the end of them. But and she didn't do it here, but she did do it there. And it was one of the first things she ever did. And, somebody could have gotten easily discouraged, you know, that here you were in this new show by Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricusse, who had just written Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And, I mean, you're a kid and you believe everything's going to work out wonderfully, and it didn't. So she had a lot of good stories, and I liked her immeasurably, and I wish her well.
You talked about that in her show.
Did she?
And she sang, "Oh, What Kind of Fool Am I?"
Ah.
But also, you know what I love, because I recently interviewed her for Talkin' Broadway, and what I love about her is, A, that, as you say, she's very honest. She's not false modest.
Not
at
all.
Which I don't really like, you know, but that doesn't mean, you know, so she knows, you know, she knows what who she is and what she can do.
That's right.
And, but she doesn't, she's also not, you know, she's not a diva, mm-hmm. you know, in any negative sense. And right. She also will say what she feels, even if it's, you know, if it's not all roses. She went on to me about how upset she was about what happened with Chess, because I asked her if she actually worked with Michael Bennett at all, because he was to have directed the London production. And she said, sadly, I only had one meeting with him, you know, very early on. And then he soon became so ill that he couldn't continue. And Trevor Nunn took over. But then she went on and she went into detail about how unhappy she was about how the vision of the show changed. And not only that, but then when they brought it to Broadway, they completely rewrote it. Richard Nelson wrote a new book for it at Trevor Nunn's behest, and they they changed her role completely, and she became the character became an American rather than a Hungarian, and she was I was basically written out of the show that was written for me originally because she had been partners with Tim Rice, and he had written it for her, so she was very 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 honest about that, and I appreciated that.
All righty. So moving on, we have just a few news things that we want to chat about for a minute before we close up for the evening. First thing is that there was an article in Broadway.com that Bartlett Sher is going to be directing the My Fair Lady revival.
Yes.
With Clive Davis helming it as a producer. So what do we think about this? Is this a good project for Bartlett Sher to do?
I would say that it sounds like a good one to me.
I thoroughly agree. He certainly took great care with South Pacific, and I imagine he's going to take the requisite care with My Fair Lady, too. I was much relieved to see that he was the director, because he does seem to come from a place of tradition, and My Fair Lady is such a specific show. I don't want to see much monkeying around with it. I don't think it can take much monkeying around.
Right.
So as a result, I'm very much at peace and at home with Bartlett Sher directing the show.
And so, the other good news about that is, as I may have mentioned, that there had been talk of a film remake with the property being rewritten by Emma Thompson. So if this prevents that from happening, it puts it on the back burner for a while longer or forever, I would be not displeased at that.
Yeah, me too.
So our friend at the Hartford Current, Frank Rizzo, wrote a piece on Valerie Harper, who we had sad news this week, has cancer, brain cancer, and it's just I encourage everybody to go to the Broadway Radio show page, and there's a link to the article so you can read that interview, which was pretty nice and inspiring.
Very tender, yes indeed. I liked it too, and she's had a very funky Broadway career because I believe you can see her in the movie of Little Abner. Am I right about that?
Quite prominently.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's one. It's put them back the way they was.
Right. Yeah.
Put them back, and I think it's a close up on her and Beth Howland, both of them in the chorus. Both of them in the chorus. It's incredible.
She was also in some ways not for sleeping, and it's one of the reasons that she wound up doing the play Thieves that Michael Bennett was involved with for a while. Now, the thing is that you might say, no. Marlo Thomas did Thieves, that play back in the 70s. Yes, she did, because Valerie Harper did one performance, which, by the way, I saw because it was in Boston trying out. And it was a very messy play. And, one really can't blame her terribly much for getting out of it because it was endless. It was also on a very unfortunate set that must have looked very good on paper. But she's really done a few things over the years and has shown up. And also, was it her apartment where you saw, Rhoda's apartment is what I mean, where you saw the window card for Dear World?
it wasn't Mary's.
It wasn't Mary's. Yeah, well, if you look at a rerun of Rhoda, look carefully and you'll see a window card of Dear World up there. I don't know if she was connected with Dear World originally or if, like, she got Mary Tyler Moore when she was supposed to do Dear World and she felt bad about it. I don't know the story, but if you look close, you'll be able to see a Dear World window card on the set. So that's something that's everybody's homework assignment for tonight, to look up an old Rhoda on YouTube and look for that window card of Dear World.
So next up is James Franco is going to make his Broadway debut of Mice and Men. All this stuff is coming up. Are we going to be happy to see James Franco finally make his debut?
Well, I hope. First of all, I hope it happens because there's already been a false start, hasn't there? Wasn't he supposed to do? Wasn't he mentioned for? Was he mentioned for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof? Or was it no Sweet Bird of
Sweet
Youth?
Yes, Sweet Bird.
With Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, aside from everything else, I'd love to see him on Broadway. But I have to tell you, I have seen several productions of Mice and Men off Broadway, and every one of them has been absolutely, you know, moved me to my core. It's such an incredibly beautiful, sad piece, and I think a lot of people know it from one or another movie versions of it, or obviously from the original novel by Steinbeck. But the play version of it is terrific. It just moves as if it was originally written as a play, and I can't tell you how powerful it is on stage. Every production I saw was terrific, but I also think that the material itself is so strong that I'm delighted that it's going to be back on Broadway. When was the last Broadway production of Mice and Men?
Boy,
didn't James Earl Jones do it at Circle in the Square or something like
that? Yeah, but that really was like 35 years ago, maybe.
Yeah,
so, I know the Roundabout did it in the 80s in a pretty good production. But
I missed that.
Yeah, that's when Roundabout had the Union Square Theater.
Right.
The thing they used to do shows there was during that era. So as a result, that's some time ago. So I would, my guess would be that's around 85, 86. So, and that might be the last, at least visible, at least semi-high profile production that it's had. So
unless you count, they actually did the opera.
Yes, that's right.
Not too many years ago at New York City Opera, they revived the opera, and actually that was a terrific, great production of that. But no, the play, don't miss it. I'm sure people will go if only for James Franco, but even if it wasn't him, I would say to go see it because it's a terrific, wonderful, beautiful, sad play.
According to IBDB, Of Mice and Men has only played two productions on Broadway, the last one being in February 1975 at the Brooks.
Yes.
So, and the first one being at the Music Box in 1937.
Well, who was in the one at the 75 one? Is that the
70, 75 one? Pamela Blair, David Clark, Kevin Conway, Pat Corkley, David Gale, Stephen Gerrish, James Earl Jones, Mark Gordon, and Joe Seneca and James Daly. Yeah, that's it.
Wow. I thought it was Circle in the Square, but thanks for correcting me.
Yes. All righty. So, and then the last thing, speaking of Broadway history, is that Kevin Davenport's blog, which I read religiously every day, he mentioned last week that when's the last time there wasn't a Sondheim show on Broadway?
Yeah, I saw that article too.
Did you see that article?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had to go back and look at it because he can't be right. But he was.
He was. He actually, I did the same thing. I checked as well. And yes, he's right. 1992 was the last time that there was no Sondheim show on Broadway. Well, of course, the year is still young.
Yeah.
And we can hope. And, you mean
in a season? Is that what you
no,
mean?
No, I think he means genuine year.
Yeah.
I think he means year. So there's still time for this one.
Yeah, we still have 9 months for somebody to rally and get some sort of show there.
Because he specifically said 1992. It wasn't like he said 1992-93.
Yeah.
1992-92. So I think he was going with the year.
A friend of mine just saw Merrily We Roll Along at the Meunier Chocolate Factory.
Yeah.
And he loved it. And this is someone who generally does not like scaled down productions. So if he loved it, it's got to be kind of amazing. So that maybe that one will make it here before the end of...
Yes, let's hope so.
Not a day goes by.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wanted to mention quickly that Musicals Tonight, this week and next week, is doing Strike Up the Band, the Gershwin musical. And so you might want to check that out. And especially because, I think... an opportunity to strike up the band anyway is pretty uncommon, but I did not know this. I was talking to Mel Miller and he told me the book was originally by George S. Kaufman. But this was a show that closed out of town. I think he said Philadelphia, maybe, in 1927. And in fact, supposedly this was the show about which Kaufman made the famous remark, satire is what closes on Saturday night. but so then it was, the book was rewritten by Maury Riskind, and the show opened on Broadway, I believe, in 1930, and it did, you know, fairly well. But this musicals tonight is doing the Kaufman version. So I don't know. That sounds kind of you know, noteworthy to me. And I sat through the first half of it tonight because I do their production photos, and I was laughing. So
okay, I never remember. One of them involves cheese, and the other one involves
cheese
chocolate.
This is the cheese one.
Cheese.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I should remember that. At least to my taste, chocolate is more delicious than cheese. So as a result. The most successful one was about chocolate. But yeah, I mean, and it's so rare when a show closes out of town that it comes back. They always say, you know, we're rethinking, we're doing repairs, we're coming back next year. They always say it, and it so rarely happens. But this was the case when it really did.
So Musicals Tonight is playing Strike Up the Band March 24th to March 12th through the 24th at the Lion Theater, 410 West 42nd Street.
Oh, I just want to, I apologize. Some, you know, we were trying to rush a little last week because we had so many things and the podcast went quite long. And I left out Stephanie Blythe in my discussion of Carousel. And I really hate to do that because she's amazing as Nettie Fowler in the Carousel that was done by the Philharmonic at Avery Fisher Hall, and which you will all get a chance to see on television on PBS on April 26th. So I did not want to leave her out. And in fact, tonight she's, well, we're recording this on Monday, the 11th. She's doing a concert at Carnegie Hall of, including a lot of, popular music, as well as her, you know, her kind of classical and opera stuff. So she's been doing a lot more of that stuff. She actually did a Kate Smith tribute concert, which is also going to be on TV. So she's moving more into musical theater and pop music, and I think you'll really want to get to know her if you don't know her already, because she's phenomenal, the really great opera star, Stephanie Blythe.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us outside of iTunes, you can get us through the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device or your BlackBerry, so you can listen to us streaming. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. All the information and some of the stories that we've talked about today is on our page at BroadwayRadio.com. Contact information for Peter and for Michael and for me, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Bye.
Good night.
Don't keep your distance. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word